Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the July 30th edition of the County Chronicle. We'll begin with the first page stories. Tuscola City Council. City spends over $600,000 on pool upgrades by David Porter. The Tuscola City Council on Monday committed to keeping the local swimming pool viable by voting to spend more than $500,000 to renovate the pool house. That was in addition to approving repairs to the slide at a cost of $63,000. Mayor Dan Clay said he sometimes jokes about the amount of money the city is spending, but he says it's an investment in the future. The pool house has served the community for more than two decades, and renovating it means it will be ready to serve the community for decades to come. The successful bidder for the work was Acra Builders at a cost of $577,000. Clay said the work will include replacing the floors and extensive plumbing and electrical work. Five companies bid on the project. Treasurer Alta Long noted that the cost will be paid out of the city's rainy day fund and not the general fund. She said there's little over $2 million in that account. Clay said the work needs to be done if the city is going to keep open the pool next summer. He said the city has done well and saved money for future projects, and this expense is for the city's future. I expected to get 25 more years out of it, he said, of the pool house. The vote was unanimous with Tim Hui absent. The council also approved $18,000 for repair to a city bucket truck. Clay said the expense is well below the cost of a new truck. Drake Scruggs was the low bidder. In another vote, the council approved $10,900 to replace the projector used at the community building. Building inspector Mike Salmon said the projector in use is now old and not working well. He noted that it is not replaced when the city renovated the community building. After questions from the council, Long affirmed that the building's audio equipment and projector are available to those who rent the building at no extra cost. However, access is only granted upon request. Following a closed session to discuss personnel and collective bargaining, the council hired Morgan Cotton as full-time police officer at a wage of $28.67 per hour. He replaces Tony Crabble, who resigned a few weeks ago. In other business, the council approved $127,000 to Grunlow Construction for the master meter station, approved a community building lease with alcohol to Perla Rodriguez for a wedding reception August 23rd. The next article, Tuscola School Board, Substitute Teachers to Get Pay Increase by David Porter. The Tuscola School Board on Monday approved an increase in pay for substitute teachers. The new rate is $140 per day. An anonymous donation of $400 was accepted for Help a Child. Following a closed session, the board voted to accept resignations from Shayla Wojas, psychologist, Nick Ross as high school student council sponsor, Shannon Stanley as speech pathologist, and Lisa Cunningham as preschool teacher. They approved the following hires: Breonna Lee, paraprofessional, Brent Budd, East Prairie History Club, Phil Weinecke, East Prairie Science Club, Christy Taylor, high school student council, Calden Bayer, high school assistant football coach, Brett Engelhart, high school volunteer baseball coach, and Dwayne Boyd, volunteer assistant football coach. The board also voted to destroy verbatim records of the older closed meetings and to keep other executive session records sealed. The next first page story, Riders Seek Larger Corral. Arcola School Board approves football co-op with Cerro Gordo Bement amid uncertainties, by Ben Crane. With just 2 weeks remaining before the start of football practice, the Arcola School Board voted 3-2 on Monday night to approve a one-year cooperative football agreement with Cerro Gordo and Bement in an order to salvage its 2025 varsity season. The decision followed about 45 minutes of discussion. Board members Jeremy Schonkweiler, Casey Conlin, and Garrett Stenger voted in favor of the co-op, while Sue Stout and Allison Wise voted no. Board President Lucas Schonweiler and Julie Leia Sanchez were absent. No student athletes attended the meeting. The board based its decision on a list of 21 potential Arcola players gathered earlier during a team information session. Of those, 13 had committed to playing, while 8 were marked as unsure. The first official day of practice is scheduled for August 11th. The agreement, however, is not yet final. Both Cerro Gordo and Bement school boards must also vote to approve the cooperative for it to move forward. Under the proposed arrangement, Arcola would host all varsity football games and daily practices. Cerro Gordo and Bement would be responsible for transporting their athletes to and from Arcola each day. Arcola's purple and white uniforms would remain in use, and the Purple Riders name and program branding would stay intact. Head coach Sergio Medina and his current staff would continue to run the team. Cerro Gordo Bement would provide assistant coaches primarily to supervise the travel. Medina would remain the program's head coach whether or not the cooperative is finalized. The agreement is designed to last only for the 2025 season, with all three districts expected to reevaluate afterward. Saragorba Met, which had already canceled its varsity season due to low turnout, indicated it would contribute up to 12 players. Only four of those, according to Arcola's superintendent, Tim Mulligan, were expected to be ready for varsity-level play. The rest would be freshmen or young sophomores, unlikely to contribute right away. Despite supporting the cooperative on paper, Mulligan changed his recommendation during the meeting after listening to concerns from Medina and reviewing the summer participation list. "I came in tonight thinking I'd recommend the co-op," Mulligan said, "but I felt the energy is in that gym, and I believe we can do this on our own." Assistant coach Franco and Medina both expressed concerns that forming a co-op might actually reduce Arcola's participation, noting that some players had indicated they might not play if athletes from other schools were brought in. "What happens if the moment we co-op, we lose 10 kids and we're right back where we started?" Franco asked. Medina also cited cultural concerns, questioning whether players from Saragorba Met would fully commit to Arcola's values if they knew the agreement was only temporary. "My concern is the culture," Medina said. "What motivation does a Saragorba sophomore have to buy in, knowing that next year he's back with a different coach in a different school?" He added that if he had to choose, he would rather commit fully to the student-athletes currently enrolled in Arcola. "I want to put my chips on the kids in this building," Medina said, "even if that means losing them all." Board member Conlon acknowledged the emotional appeal of staying independent, but said the numbers made the decision too risky. "We're debating unsure," Conlon said. "Even if we get all 22 players, how many are left after week 5? If we start with 3 tough games and can't finish the season, that sets us back worse than where we are now." Schonkweiler echoed that sentiment, emphasizing the need to protect the future of the program. "I'm not willing to gamble the football program on the chance that a few extra kids might come out," Schonkweiler said. "We can't go into a season hoping." Principal Nick Lindsay called the situation short-term fix to a short-term problem, but acknowledged the need for long-term accountability. "If this were only about football, maybe the answer is simple," Lindsay said, "but it's not. It's about culture, commitment, and setting up young men for success in life, not just in uniform." If the co-op is approved by Saragorba Met, Arcola's practices will begin under the combined arrangement on August 11th. If either district declines, Arcola will proceed independently, relying on its existing players and continuing recruiting efforts to build a sustainable roster. "We've always done what's best to give our kids opportunities," Lindsay said. "We just have to make sure we don't lose sight of who we are in the process." Again, this week there don't seem to be any obituaries, so we'll move to the next article. RC Fest ends on a high note by Ben Crane out of Tuscola. One of the nation's top-rated remote control RC events came to close this weekend as McKenzie and Adam Munns wrapped up a 5-year run organizing the RC Fest, a nationally acclaimed event that doubles as a fundraiser for Impact Live, a regional blood center. The couple, who returned to Tuscola in 2020 at the request of Impact Life after a 4-year hiatus from the event, announced this year would be their last time hosting. The decision, they said, wasn't due to burnout, but a desire to embrace a new phase of life. "We put in a solid 5 years," McKenzie said. "We just got married last year. We want to travel and do things. We're in our 20s. It felt like a good number to end on." RC Fest has drawn national attention over the years, bringing in participants from across the country and setting itself apart with professional-level organization, a unique blend of RC activities, and strong charitable mission. "This year was by far our biggest," McKenzie said. "We had participants from 26 states, and at least 19 actually showed up, including folks from California, Florida, New Hampshire, and New Mexico. In total, more than 212 competitors took part across a range of events, including trail closures, courses, sand racing, monster trucks, and RC boats. The highlight," McKenzie told us, "was the Golden Snitch RC event, which drew 5 rounds and more than 50 people. A total of 90 trail vehicles and 88 sand racers competed, and 54 individuals participated in the RC soccer event." Behind the scenes, the event was coordinated by a lean crew of just 4 people throughout the year, growing to about a dozen during the weekend, including family, close friends, and even willing spectators who pitched in when needed. "We work really hard just with a small team," McKenzie said. "We built something really special, and people respond to that. There's fun, of course, but there's purpose, too. This goes back to the blood bank." That purpose wasn't just symbolic. The Impact Life Bloodmobile collected 19 blood donations during the weekend, enough to help potentially save 60 lives. Adam, who handled the bulk of logistics and sponsor coordination and the decision to step away, was bittersweet. "I do feel proud," he said. "I got to fulfill a childhood dream, meet my childhood idol, and see what this could become. I might have a lot of free time now, which will feel strange, but I know we're leaving on a high note." The event originally ran from 2012 to 2016 before taking a break. In 2020, amid COVID-19 pandemic, Impact Life approached the Munzes, asking them to bring it back. At the time, the region was starved for public events, and RC Fest offered a safe and engaging experience for families and hobbyists alike. This was something people could really rally around, Mackenzie said. We did good marketing, yes, but people came because it was meaningful. Though RC Fest is ending for now, the couple hasn't ruled out a future return. I talked about the blood bank yesterday, Adams said. They asked, if we need you again, will you be there? And the answer is yes. If there's a nationwide shortage and a real need, we'll step in. For now, the Munzes are looking forward to rest, travel, and life beyond event planning. We're so thankful, Mackenzie said, to our sponsors, our volunteers, our supporters. It's long, it's hot, it's a ton of work, but it was worth it. The next article, County Fair opens with a prayer service. Fair runs through Saturday in Arthur by Marty Yackel. The 94th annual Moultrie-Douglas County Fair officially opened on Sunday evening, July 27th, with a church service on the fairgrounds. The church service is a long-standing tradition. The service opened with the Arthur Boy Scout Troop No. 74 leading the Pledge of Allegiance. A nice crowd braved the heat and enjoyed hearing the local gospel group, College of Faith. They shared several songs and even encouraged those in attendance to sing along at times. Several pastors also participated, and John Stewart, First Baptist Church, shared the message for the evening. Also on Sunday evening, Sweer Amusements was busy setting up rides and booths. The Ferris wheel was one of the first carnival rides to be put up on the fairgrounds. The fair runs through Saturday with many events, exhibits, and entertainment on tap. A calendar of those things can be found on the Moultrie-Douglas County Fair Facebook page. The next article, feds weigh in on lawsuit challenging how Illinois maintains voter registration rolls. Suit alleges Illinois fails to properly maintain registration lists by Peter Hancock. The U.S. Department of Justice added its voice this month to a lawsuit by private entities accusing the state of Illinois of failing to properly maintain a statewide voter registration list in violation of a 1993 federal law. In a filing known as a Statement of Interest, the Justice Department said the government has an interest in the outcome of the lawsuit, although the filing stops short of asking the court permission to intervene as a party in the case. This case presents important questions regarding enforcement of the National Voting Registration Act, attorneys in DOJ's Civil Rights Division said in the filing. Congress has vested the Attorney General with the authority to enforce the NVRA, National Voter Registration Act, on behalf of the United States. Accordingly, the United States has a substantial interest in ensuring proper interpretation of the NVRA. The lawsuit challenges the state's practice of delegating to local election officials the responsibility of conducting regular maintenance of voter registration rolls, including the task of purging people from the rolls when they die or move out of the jurisdiction. Under NVRA, the suit argues the state is responsible for carrying out this function. The U.S. District Court for the Northern Illinois District of Illinois, Judge Sarah Ellis, has indicated she could decide the case at a hearing currently scheduled for July 30th. The DOJ filing comes at the same time the Trump administration has been launching multi-pronged efforts for the federal government to exert more influence over voter registration in the United States, a task traditionally reserved for states. In March, Trump signed an executive order purporting to require people to show documentary proof of U.S. citizenship when they register to vote. That order has since been blocked from being enforced while a legal challenge proceeds. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reported July 16th that the DOJ has asked at least 9 other states for complete copies of their voter rolls, and at least two reportedly have turned them over. So far, the DOJ has not requested similar data from Illinois. Officials at the Illinois State Board of Elections declared to comment on the DOJ filing say they do not comment on pending litigation. The basis of the lawsuit. The suit was filed in 2024 by Judicial Watch, a conservative legal advocacy group known for filing Freedom of Information Act lawsuits to investigate allegations of official misconduct. Other plaintiffs include the Wheaton-based Breakthrough Ideas, a conservative advocacy group headed by former Republican State Representative Gene Ives, Illinois Family Action, a Christian political advocacy group based in Tinley Park, and Carol G. Davis, identified as DuPage County resident and member of Judicial Watch. The complaint is based on a provision of the NVRA that requires states to conduct a general program that makes a reasonable effort to remove the names of ineligible voters from the official lists of eligible voters if they have died or changed their address. The complaint also cites federal regulations that require each state's chief executive officer to submit various kinds of election-related data to the Federal Election Assistance Commission, including the total number of registrations statewide that were for whatever reason, deleted from the registration list between the past 2 federal general elections. The Election Commission collects that data and publishes biennial reports that are delivered to Congress summarizing information it receives. According to the complaint, the Commission's reports indicate that much of the required information from Illinois was missing. For example, the complaint notes that from November 2020 through November 2022, 11 Illinois counties reported removing zero voters from their registration list, suggesting that no registered voters had moved or died in those counties over the two-year period. 12 other counties reported removing 15 or fewer registrations over that same period. The complaint describes these as absurdly small numbers, given that those 23 counties were home to more than 980,000 registered voters. A letter to Judicial Watch responding to a request to supply the missing data, State Board of Elections Executive Director Bernadette Matthews wrote that the agency does not mandate such information because Illinois has a bottom-up jurisdiction where local jurisdiction, including 102 counties and 6 municipal election authorities, are responsible for maintaining their own voter registration lists. This makes sense, as local election authorities are responsible for determining a voter's continuing eligibility to vote in their jurisdiction, Matthews wrote. The plaintiffs, however, argued that NVRA gives states the responsibility for keeping voter registration lists up to date, and they cannot delegate that responsibility to local jurisdictions. That is also the argument that the DOJ made in its statement of interest. By its plain terms, the NVRA requires one entity, the state, to carry out the administration of voter registration for federal elections, the DOJ argued. The defendant's response. Illinois Attorney General's Office, which is defending the State Board of Elections, has filed a motion to dismiss the complaint, arguing that the plaintiffs lack standing in bringing the suit. It also claims the plaintiffs have not stated a valid claim because NVRA allows states to delegate its responsibilities to local authorities. Two labor unions, the Illinois AFL-CIO and the Illinois Federation of Teachers, have intervened in support of the state's position. They argue they spend considerable resources to ensure their members can vote in Illinois elections, and they have the interest in making sure that none of their members are unlawfully purged from the voter rolls if their plaintiffs succeed in the case. The next article, Food Prices to Follow Inflation Uptick, Beef Hits Record High by Rhiannon Branch. After a few months of a downward trend, inflation is on the rise again with food prices following suit. The latest Consumer Price Index, CPI, increased 0.3% in June and 2.7% in the past 12 months. Food prices rose faster than overall inflation. The CPI for all food increased 0.3% from April to May, with food prices in May 2.9% higher than a year ago. Prices for beef and veal jumped 8.6% higher in May compared to a year ago. Overall, beef and veal prices are predicted to increase 6.8% this year due to tight supplies and continued consumer demand. U.S. demand for beef has remained strong, even as prices hit record highs, said Bernd Nelson, American Farm Bureau Federation economist, who noted the domestic cattle supply is at a 74-year low. Meanwhile, pork prices rose 0.7% from April to May and 0.6% higher than in May 2024. Pork prices are predicted to increase a modest 0.5% in 2025. In contrast to beef, pork production is projected to increase this year. It's a bit of a delicate balance, and especially with all the global uncertainty, more measured pork production growth is probably beneficial in these times, said Aaron Borer, U.S. Meat Export Federation. Retail egg prices decreased for the second month in a row, falling 7.5%. Egg prices in May were still 41% higher than in May 2024, continuing to experience volatile month-to-month changes due to an outbreak of highly pathogenic avian influenza that began in 2022. In April, confirmed cases of HPAI tapered, and in May, the number of confirmed detections remained low compared with earlier in the year. Egg prices are predicted to increase 33% in 2025, which includes price increases already realized from January through March of 2025. USDA reported that even if retail egg prices continue to decrease over the coming months, higher prices realized earlier in the year will continue to factor into the forecast. In 2025, overall food prices are anticipated to rise at about the historic average rate of growth. This year, prices for all foods are predicted to increase 2.9%, with food at home prices up 2.2% and food away from home prices up 3.9%. Prices for poultry, sugar, and sweets, and non-alcoholic beverages are predicted to increase, while prices for items like fresh vegetables are expected to ease. USDA shows farmers made and paid more for products in May. The index of prices received for May rose 1.7% due to gains in categories like cattle, hogs, and milk. That offset losses in categories like broilers, market eggs, lettuce, and strawberries. The index of prices paid was up 0.4% as increased costs for categories like feeder cattle, hay and forage, and nitrogen canceled out decreases in some categories, including feeder pigs, self-propelled machinery, LP gas, and complete feeds. Compared to a year ago, the index of prices received was 13% higher thanks to a boost in livestock prices, while the index of prices was up 6.4%. The next article, Innovative Farmer Opening Deep-Fried Popcorn Market by Hannah Spangler. What started as a kitchen experiment in a Knox County farm has grown into a deep frying method that could bring popcorn to restaurant menus and open fresh opportunities for specialty crop growers. Andrew Bowman of Pilot Farm Knob Farm near Oneida has developed a specialized fryer basket that allows restaurants to deep fry popcorn using existing kitchen equipment. The innovation could clear a new market for this family-grown, hullless red and blue popcorn. "We're very excited for this," Bowman said. "It'll be a novel way for people to experience our no-toothpick-required popcorn." The concept addresses a common challenge for small-scale food producers, breaking into a crowded grocery store shelves. Despite strong feedback to taste and quality, Bowman said it's been difficult to scale retail sales due to the sheer number of products grocery buyers manage. That challenge led Bowman to explore new markets where his popcorn could stand out. The idea came from a viral video his son found online. After testing the concept in a small fryer, Bowman realized deep-fried popcorn could offer restaurants a unique, quick-cooking side that fits easily into existing kitchen routines. "Can you imagine having a nice bowl of popcorn to go with some cheese curds at Culver's or a nice sandwich or a steak at Texas Roadhouse?" Bowman told RFD Radio Network's DeLoss Junkie. The key is a custom-designed fryer basket made from food-grade perforated stainless steel. It allows popcorn to be cooked in a standard deep fryer right alongside fries or onion rings. While the basket is more complex and costly than typical fryer equipment, Bowman said the goal isn't to sell hardware. "We're not equipment salesmen, we're farmers," he said. "We want people to enjoy the bounty from our family farm." Instead, Pilot Knob Farm plans to provide the baskets at little or no cost to restaurants that agree to source their popcorn exclusively from the farm. It's a model designed to build long-term relationships and open new sales channels for a product that's already proven popular with consumers. Bowman is offering a pilot program for restaurants interested in trying the product. Participating establishments will receive free popcorn and temporary use of the custom fryer baskets at no upfront cost. The goal is to fine-tune both the equipment and the process before scaling up. Bowman said he's especially interested in working with Illinois-based restaurants and food entrepreneurs who value local sourcing and are open to offering something new on their menus. "It's a phenomenal product. It tastes amazing," Bowman said. "Now we just have to execute on it, and that part is going to require feedback." There's an article, Hook, Line, and Sinker by Tony Hooker, reflecting on the national anthem. "The old sailor stood at attention, his back as straight as six decades of poor choices would allow it. Hands cupped at his sides, in line with the seams of his khaki shorts, his gaze was focused unwaveringly on the flag as the Fair Queen played the Star-Spangled Banner on her violin. A bit of annoyance played around the corner of his eyes as those near him fluttered and chatted during its playing. He remembered a time when this moment commanded absolute silence, a collective reverence for the symbols of this nation. Each member of his recruit company smartly dressed in their crackerjack dress blues, the company commander watching like eagles ready to dole out punishment to anyone who faltered. Back then, strict attention was given and the air thrummed with a quiet dignity. Now for many it was just background noise, a quaint tradition to endure before the real fun of the fair began. A toddler wailed nearby, a group of teenagers snickered, and a woman loudly recounted her mourning to a friend. Each sound grated on his ears, a dissonant counterpoint to the relaxed soft tones of the violin. He smiled wryly as he remembered when he was one of those teens too cool for school. He and his cronies thought they were the center of the universe, even though they lived 10 miles south of Philo. He wondered if they even heard the words, if they understood the weight of the sacrifice woven into every thread of that flag, every note of that anthem. Did they know of the battles fought, the lives lost, the quiet, persistent struggle for freedom they so casually enjoyed? Or was it just a pretty tune, a colorful piece of cloth, devoid of meaning in their fast-paced, self-absorbed world? Again, he smiled as he thought of the hard-fought experiences that had brought him to this point of understanding and reverence, and for an instant he envied those boys because life hadn't hit them yet, like it was sure to do, like it does to all of us. The Fair Queen finished with a flourish, and thunderous applause broke out at the unique touch she had brought to the national anthem, and he knew. He knew that even though appearances and ways of looking at life have changed, deep down, the generations, deep down, there are many who still love and honor this beautiful mess of a country that we call the United States of America. Sure, a little more respect during the playing of the national anthem was warranted, but the old sailor was sure glad to live in a country where kids were free to be knuckleheads, within reason. A country store where a beautiful Fair Queen could amaze folks with her talents, where corn dogs and cotton candy were the order of the day, where monster truck drivers could compel their behemoth beast into feats of wonder and then pose for pictures with their adoring young fans, where an old man could pay his respects to Old Glory while remembering another season of his life, all the while hanging out with his grandson, whose seasons are just beginning. What a great place this is that we call home. Sometimes it's good to be reminded of that simple truth. For me, last week was one of those times. The next article, Small Businesses Protecting Your Personal Assets with an LLC, by Mabel Alacon Craven. Many small businesses start as bootstrapped one-person operations where you just your idea and a whole lot of hustle. But as your business grows, so do your responsibilities and risks. You might begin taking on bigger projects, handling more income, or working with contractors and vendors. Once you reach this point, it may be time to consider formalizing your business. Formatting a limited liability company, or LLC, is one of the most popular ways to do it. An LLC is the most common business structure among business owners with fewer than 10 employees. As its name suggests, the LLC offers liability protection, meaning the business owner's assets, things like their home, vehicle, and personal bank account, are usually protected from the business's debts and liabilities. The LLC is considering a separate legal entity from the business owner. In addition to the liability protection it provides provided by an LLC, it's easy to operate. This structure allows flexibility in taxation and management and can have unlimited members, owners, and doesn't require a board of directors. Forming an LLC can give your business a boost in credibility and professionalism, which can strengthen relationships with banks, investors, and customers alike. Banks often prefer working with a formal business entities, making it easier to open business accounts or secure financing. The LLC structure signals potential investors that you've taken steps to protect your personal assets and clarify ownership, which can make your business more attractive. Customers and clients may also view an LLC as a sign of legitimacy and stability, helping to build trust in your brand. While an LLC doesn't guarantee success, it can create a solid foundation for growth and open doors to opportunities that might be harder to access as sole proprietorship or informal partnership. Established in 1973, the Center for Rural Affairs is a private, nonprofit organization working to strengthen small businesses. And we have time for some briefs. Tuscola citywide garage sales will be September 19th through 20th. Arcola's are August 1st through the 2nd. Tuscola Class of 68 plans a mini reunion. Members of the Tuscola High School Class of 1968, along with friends and classmates from 67 and 69, are invited to a mini reunion on Tuesday, August 5th at 4 p.m. at Yoder's Restaurant in Arthur. All attendees are welcome to enjoy the buffet dinner and reconnect with old friends. Alice Tingley, Colorado, and Tim Hole, Illinois, will serve as greeters and hosts. All TCHS alumni are welcome. Plenty of seating is available, but RSVPs are encouraged. Contact Alex at 720-260-1188 or Tim at 217-493-0449 to confirm attendance. More than 20 have already RSVP'd. We are neat. We are great. We're the class of 68. Blood drives. There'll be a community blood drive in Atwood from 9 a.m. till 12 noon August 16th during the Apple Dumpling Festival. The donor bus will be in the former Kirby Clinic parking lot at 108 South Main Street. To donate, call 800-747-5401 or visit www.bloodcenter.org and use code 71038 to locate the drive. Villa Grove will host a community blood drive with Impact Life 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, August 9th, 9 South Main Street, inside the donor bus in front of the VFW on the street. Call 1-800-747-5401 or visit www.bloodcenter.org and use code 70301 for an appointment. And that is all we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerke saying goodbye and see you again next week.